Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Lee Boyce today is Tanya Jeffries and a very special guest, This Is Money Pensions Agony Uncle, Sir Steve Webb. And coming up, if you want to take advantage of a special offer to fill holes in your state pension, well, you better get your skates on. The deadline looms, but This Is Money readers are still battling long delays. The government's responded with a callback request service. Will it work? Also today, why do I need more than the average salary for a comfortable retirement? Asks one reader. So Steve answers. And why are some key elements of the state pension only going up by 1.7% in April? Plus, save hundreds by beating Bill Mageddon. From water to council tax, the six big bill hikes coming next month. And five tips for bidding at auction houses online and bagging bargains from our very own Lee Boyce. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, people with holes in their state pension records have just one more month to take advantage of a special offer. That sounds so exciting, doesn't it? To buy missing years going as far back as 2006. As long as you get your payment or callback request in, by the 5th of April, you can still benefit from the deal. But after that, you'll only be able to fill gaps from the past 6 years. This Is Money's Tanya Jeffries has been on the case of this, as has Sir Steve Webb. And what they've uncovered, Tanya, is, well, a lot of people struggling to get through. The government's acted. Will it be enough? We'll get into that in a second. But first, Tanya. So, Steve, welcome. Lee, sit yourself down, have a cup of tea, chill out while the pension gurus take over the first half of this pod. Tanya, welcome. Steve, welcome. Tanya, just remind us, what are top-ups? What is this deadline?
It's a voluntary contribution towards your state pension, which allows you to fill in historical gaps in your record. It does give, in most cases, a pretty generous boost to your state pension. And at the current rate for, say, 2023, it would take you about 3.5 years to earn it back once you've paid it or once you've retired. So a lot of people are trying to take advantage of this deal. Some are hearing about it now and some have been trying for some time to take advantage of it because there's a lot of pressure on the phone lines. The government has launched an online tool. It did this about a year ago, which makes it a lot easier to do the purchase if you've got a fairly straightforward case. But if you've got any questions, because your case might be a bit complicated, or in certain cases where you're actually not allowed to use the tool, such as if you're buying years when you were self-employed, or, for example, these were years where you were living and working abroad, then you still have to ring up and have a conversation, basically, to find out whether it's worthwhile and what to do. As we've said many times, the system is unfortunately run jointly by HMRC and the DWP, and they both deal with separate stages of the process. HMRC looks after their national insurance records and updating them, and it deals with taking the payments. The DWP is in charge of updating forecasts, and also, if you've already passed state pension age, increasing your payments because you bought top-ups. People do have to try and work out where they are in that process, and if they have got a problem, call the right department.
I'll get more into that in more detail, Tanya, but I just want to go back. So this is basically, Sir Steve, about how much you get in state pension depends on how many years you've been contributing for your national insurance. And some people, perhaps, as Tanya says, you've been abroad or you've taken some time out to have a child or something like that. You may have a few gaps and this can help you get a bit more bang for your buck in your old age, right? Is it worth buying it, though? Who is this for? Who will it benefit? Let's talk pounds and pence here. How much will it get you?
So there's a headline rate of the new state pension, which is £221.20 a week. And if you're going to get that anyway, you've either already got there or you're going to carry on working and get there, then you don't need to worry about this. But if you've retired already or you're coming up to retirement and you've been told you're not going to get there based on the work you're still going to do, then you can go back and look at gaps in your record. And an obvious group of people are people who've retired early. So a lot of people can draw, say, a teacher's pension or something like that at the age of 60. A lot do. You know, they want to stop as soon as they can, which means all those years, 61, 62, 63, when they're at those ages, are gaps in their record. And people who've been in workplace pensions, like teachers, nurses, civil servants, people who work for a big company, have some money knocked off their state pension because they were paying essentially into the company pension instead of the state pension. So there's quite a lot of people who write to us and say, I've got 38 years, 40 years, 41 years, and I've been told I won't get a full pension. What's going on? And short answer is, that's what's going on. There was a period when you paid less in, so you get less out. But the good news is you can fix that. You can fix it by paying these extra years. But you have to check. And that's why, as Tanya says, using the online tool if you can, or speaking to somebody, always check before you hand over a penny. But in general, because it's subsidized by the government, for most people, unless you're going to be on benefit in retirement, or unless you've got a very short, sadly, life expectancy, for most people, 3 or 4 years into retirement, you've got the money back and the rest is pure profit. So, you know, it's just over £800 to fill 1 year. And, you know, you're getting over £200 a year on your pension for that. So within 4 years, you're up.
Obviously, you're not financially advising anyone here, but you know, for some people, it would be a very, very good thing to do.
Oh, hugely. As I say, if the government was simply, if they'd done the maths and worked out on average that you wouldn't gain or you wouldn't lose, then we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. But for reasons which still slightly surprise me, they subsidise it. They don't charge you the full value of what you're getting back. There aren't many bits of when you engage with government that this can be said of, but this is one of them.
Tanya, at the start, I said it was a very special offer, which made it sound like woo. But why was the government deciding to do that? And then why are we going back to six? Why don't they just do it all the time? That any years you've missed out throughout your working career, you can just buy.
It's always traditionally been 6 years, and some years ago they decided to do this offer. Steve could probably tell us the exact reason why they did it. Was it to do with pension freedom, Steve, that they did this?
Yeah, it was when the new state pension came in. So because the new state pension's based around 35 years and the old one was based around 30, all these people suddenly said, oh, hang on, I need to fill a lot more years. You've suddenly made me work 5 years more, that kind of idea. So the government said, well, if people want to fill some extra years, we can't just go back 6 years because that would be very, very tight. So we'll go back to 2006, which was when the rules change was going back a decade. And they've just kept
Sorry.
that 2006. And now that special offer, as you say, time limited, buy while stocks last, I believe is the phrase, but no advice.
Tanya, last time we were talking about this, I tried to get on to the government gateway. I just wanted to check how many years' contributions have I got? And subsequent to our conversation, I went back on again. And I'm stuck. It keeps going. Google Authenticator doesn't work, doesn't accept the code. I have to call them up. I couldn't think of anything worse, particularly at this time when the phone lines are jammed anyway. Why is this always such a hassle? But anyway, tell me about the experiences of your readers. Some of them are going through a bit of a time of it.
Yeah, so some of them have paid money and then been told, oh, it's going to take 6 months for your state pension to increase. These are people who are aged over 66. Other people paid way back last year, early last year, last spring, and still have seen no change. At that point, you really start thinking, my money must have got lost in the system somewhere. In some cases, I think that there's an issue that arises with it, a question that needs to be answered, but nobody actually pursues it. And so it just doesn't get updated or progressed in any way. And the real problem is that when people ring up, that's not discovered and then sorted out and resolved. It's just people ring up and ring up and ring up and constantly get fobbed off and are told, oh, well, there's a backlog. I think when someone rings up and say, look, I paid money in April 2024 and nothing's happened, there really should be a way of escalating that so it actually gets sorted out rather than just leaving people hanging. There's clearly a problem at that stage, but that doesn't seem to be happening. We get a lot of readers contacting us all the time, and sometimes it's not spring 2024, it's spring 2023, and they still can't get it sorted. And this is where we step in. We can't help everybody, but we do try it and help the most serious cases. We also encourage people to contact their MP and try to get them to sort it out. Even if you're an expat, I think that you can contact the MP in the last constituency you lived in, and they should be open to helping you in that scenario. But it's immensely frustrating when people have handed over their own savings for this, and the money's just vanished in their eyes, and they can just find no one to help. There's just no one when they call up who will actually sort the problem out for them. I really think that there's a customer service problem at the DWP. Their response is lately has been, we're putting in more resources to deal with this rush before the deadline. But what about all the people with the older problems that still need to be resolved?
Lee Boyce is shaking your head there. You're not impressed.
No, I think Tanya's written a story this week in which, we've got four or five readers in there that have paid in to do this, and it's taken too much time. And it does feel like we were having this conversation in the office the other day. It feels like your money's in limbo. It feels like it's in the ether somewhere. You've transferred this money, and it's just you don't know where it's gone. Now, it's bad enough if it's taken 6 months. It's terrible. It's taken 12 months. We were getting cases at 2 years. How is there not some sort of priority for those people that have seen that money just floating around for ages? Now, I try to muster up some degree of sympathy for the DWP because it could be quite complex. But it's quite clear that more resources need to be pushed into this because the deadline is coming up. It's only going to get more and more people panicked doing it at the last minute. Look, we're journalists. We know what it's like. We leave everything to the last minute. The general public on the whole, they've had a long time to do this, but they will. This month, those phone lines will be jammed. Those websites will be crashing because people will be trying to find out whether or not they can benefit from this or not. It's almost like a bit of a slow-moving car crash because we knew it was coming. It was there, the deadline, and it's because it's been pushed back a few times. I don't think it's going to be pushed back again. We're going to talk about this in a sec, but it's clear that more needs to be done. And we had a conversation just before the podcast started rolling, and was talking to Steve. We have also had more people applying for pension credit because of the winter fuel allowance. So again, they've been quite swamped in that regard. But it's a kind of one of those problems where it's like, well, you probably need more staff then to cope with this. Temporary staff that can come in and help, take the kind of sting out of this. But it never seems to happen. And there's always something extra that seems to be needed to be done at a government department, usually the DWP, where something's happened and there's more strain on the service. And I just think it's really unacceptable for cases like this to be going 2 years. 2 years is a long time to have sorted this out, done the right thing, and just not know where that money is. And we've got people that just that have perhaps moved overseas, for example. Can you imagine trying to get in contact with DWP while you're somewhere abroad? I can't even that thought is one of those sort of like nightmare scenarios to me that I can't even that would keep me up at night.
Yeah, me too. So Steve, you've worked at the heart of government. Spill the beans. What really goes on? Why can't they? How do they get to this stage?
I think it's one of those ones where if you ask people in an opinion poll, do you think there's too much waste and bureaucracy in government? They'd say yes. If you ask them, do you think we should cut bureaucrats, civil servants, or they're all doing nothing, they're all staying at home, working from home, they're all inefficient, should we? Everyone would say yes. But then when you actually encounter the system, you wish there were more people. And so the Chancellor's asking every department to save running costs. In the DWP, running costs is people. It's people who answer the phone. It's people who process benefit claims. So we can't simultaneously say we want them to spend less money and employ fewer people, but we also want them to devote more. Now, of course, I'm not making excuses for poor service, and it could be better run and all the rest of it. But there is a limit. But I think Tanya and Lee make an important point that when people don't get a good service on the first call, what do? They phone again. and again and again. And that's what you do, isn't it? And of course, that has got to be an inefficient way of dealing with things, you know, because if you could deal with it on the first call, you don't have all these people making second and third calls. And I guess the other thing I'd say, Georgie, is I wouldn't want to put people off. I mean, it's just possible people might think, oh, it's such a nightmare. I give up. I go back under the duvet. You know, inevitably, the people for whom this works don't phone us. They don't write to us. They don't contact us. So, you know, a lot of people just do this thing. It works. And they're glad they did. So just to give a sense of balance, yeah, it's absolutely unacceptable. And I'm as passionate as anybody about helping people when things have gone wrong. But it is still a very good thing for most people to think about doing.
The voice of reason there, Steve, the voice of reason. I'm saying it now, Lee, 2 years' time, we'll be having the same problem, but we'll be talking about AI chatbots. Tanya, callback request service. Tell us what you can do.
If you go to the state pension forecast page, it should take you to an option where you can put in a callback request. And as long as you get that in before the deadline, then you'll be put in a queue and they will call you and sort you out eventually. And apparently you will then be able to buy the top-ups. Even if your payment comes in after the 5th of April, you will still be allowed to buy the years going back. So it is worth putting in that callback request. The government information advises you to take a screenshot of your confirmation. I would think that's a good idea. I have a feeling that a lot of people will be putting in these callback requests. They'll be absolutely deluged with them, and it probably will take several months to work through them. I have a feeling that, especially after 5th of April, we'll be getting quite a lot of emails from people saying, I put in a callback request and I haven't had a callback. Am I lost in the system? So we'll be having lost callback requests as well as lost payments. And it is anxiety inducing for people. Obviously, they haven't paid over money at that point, but they will be worried. So I would just get your request in, make sure you've got the proof, and then I think it'll be a matter of waiting it out. But as Steve said, people should not be put off doing this. If you think this will improve your state pension, you could live a long time in retirement, during which you could be hundreds and thousands of pounds better off as a result of doing this. So it is worth persevering. They've set up this callback system. Get in the queue if you think it will benefit you.
Just briefly, Tanya, do you think they should have just extended the deadline rather than this sort of half measure? Lee's saying no. Steve, yes, no. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Should they have... No, he says no. That's two no's, Tanya.
Well, I'm a no too, because this all happened 2 years ago and they extended the deadline twice. They extended it past the election. And now here we are, spring of 25, there's yet another rush. There'll always be more people coming for this. The callback solution, if it works, if it doesn't melt down in and of itself, I think it probably is the best halfway house. Do you know though, if in the next couple of weeks they announce they are extending the deadline, I won't be surprised. I don't think they should either. And I think on balance they won't, but I won't be surprised.
Watch this space. Right. Reader question time for Pensions Agony Uncle Sir Steve Webb, former pensions minister and our partner at LCP. Bear with me on this one. So the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association, writes the reader, seems to have issued advice on appropriate pension levels for different lifestyles in retirement. We've talked about that a lot on the podcast. This is laudable, says the reader. However, it has left me somewhat confused. The amounts recommended are after tax and do not include housing costs, but appear in many cases to exceed current average income levels of working people who are presumably paying for mortgages and children. The PLSA provides a figure of £43,100 being required for a single person for a comfortable retirement. That would, by my calculations, require a pre-tax income of approximately £53,000. You can add another, say, £15,000 gross to that to cover the mortgage taken from the net income. Even then, I think that's low, says the reader. In practice, you'd need around £68,000 to £70,000 of income. That's almost twice the average UK salary, according to the ONS. So, Sir Steve, even including the state pension, how can people save sufficiently to provide an income in retirement which they cannot even earn in salary? What am I missing? Over to you, Pensions Agony Uncle, Steve.
And it's a great question, actually. So to be fair to the Pensions and Lifetime Saving Association, sort of trade body of all the pension schemes, until they did this exercise, there wasn't really much out there. So people would say, how much do I need for retirement? What's the sort of And everyone said, oh, I don't know, two-thirds of your salary or something, I don't know. So they've done a big piece of work, proper piece of work. They update it every few years. And what they do is they say to real people, not just high earners, but everybody, think about retirement. Think about the things that you absolutely have to have. And we'll call that a minimum standard. Think about things that would be kind of moderate, you know, be quite nice to have a better holiday, that kind of stuff, you know, run a car. And then think about what really comfortable looks like. And they put a price tag on all of that. And that gives us the figures you've just quoted, Georgie. And I suppose one answer to the question is, actually, most of us can't afford the kind of retirement most of us think we'd like. You know, that one of the reasons these numbers are high is because when you ask people, they have quite high aspirations for retirement, and many of us will fall short. There is a slight subtlety in this, which is most of us reach pension age as part of a couple. And there are different numbers for couples, and they aren't quite so scary when there's two of you. So a slightly facetious answer to your question, Georgie, is have somebody else's income as well as yours. But, you know, that's part of the mix. But clearly, when this turns into a pot, you know, I need a pot of X £100,000, it just looks terribly scary. But remember, your company are paying in too, the government's paying in too. You know, this isn't all on you. So I think part of the answer is, you know, we know we're not saving enough. We know very few of us will get to this comfortable standard, but you can get to a better standard, you know, ideally with somebody else's income, but, you know, making the most of what your employer will do and, you know, being willing to start as soon as you can. So, you know, there's things you can do, but it is a big ask.
I do like these PLSA figures because I like the fact that they present it in what you can afford to buy. And for a modest income in retirement, they give you £4 a carling, which if that's not going to encourage you to save so you don't have to drink carling in your retirement, I don't know what
that's
else
not
is.
Even a night out for you, Georgie, is it really? £4
a carling. Oh, Steve, I wouldn't touch carling. You're joking.
Georgie, I've got a hard agree with you on that. that's a bleak retirement, man. Like £4 a carling a week is a bleak retirement. That should prompt you to save harder. Totally agree. Couldn't agree.
Whereas I think comfortable is a bottle of Sauvignon, which, you know. Right, let's go move on because soon we'll be talking about Awful April. I know Lee loves that title, but it is the month that rivals January for the most miserable because there are so many bill rises, basically. And before that, let's talk about people getting more money. So the state pension is going up in a month with the headline rate at 4.1% thanks to the triple lock. So why, Tanya, does your article say that elements of it only going up by 1.7%? Firstly, the triple lock, explain what happens to the state pension every year.
The triple lock is a guarantee given by the government that the state pension will rise every year by the highest of 2.5% average earnings growth or CPI inflation. And it's taken from the figures in the previous autumn. So it was last autumn's figures that are key for what's happening now. This year it was earnings growth, but CPI was 1.7% and earnings growth was 4.1%. What people don't realise is the headline rates go up by 4.1%, but certain elements are actually set instead by CPI inflation. It's really a matter of looking at your state pension statement, which I understand is sent out every year, and it will list all the various elements. And so you have to look at which bits are going to go up by CPI, which bits are going to go up by the headline rate. Some people will just get the headline rate. If you're on the full new state pension because you retired since 2016 and you qualified for the full amount, you will just get the triple locked amount. But they're obviously a lot of people with different circumstances. We've written a story breaking down all the elements so you can go and check and compare your breakdown with what's on there to work out what you're going to get. But the government will surely tell you.
Steve, just a final one before I let you both go. Triple lock, is it going to stay?
I think for this parliament, yes. It was a manifesto commitment. And although, you know, manifesto commitments get broken and, you know, stuff happens, World War III or whatever, because they used the triple lock as a defence for the winter fuel payment cut, they said, oh, well, you know, yes, we did something over here, but look at this shiny thing we're doing over here. It'll be especially hard to go back on it now. So I think it will survive. And then all of the parties will be waiting for somebody else to blink first. Yeah, they'd all right to get off the hook. But if you're coming up to an election, it's very hard to be the first one to say, well, we're not going to be as generous to pensioners. And everyone else will breathe a sigh of relief and keep their heads down, and you get all the flak. So that's to some extent why we keep getting it every 5 years, because nobody wants to move first. So if the government was sensible, they would say now, we affirm our promise to the triple lot for the next 4 years, and then we'll link the pension to wages after that or something sufficiently far out from a general election for it not to be just, you know, as much of a political football as it will anyway, I think.
Is that your solution, link to wages?
In the medium term, yes. So I still think the state pension's on the low side, but once you've used the triple lock to get it to a decent level, then you kind of lock it, as it were, third of the average wage or something like that as a steady way of doing it.
Steve, Tanya, thank you so much for your time. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Rob Morgan from Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Invest in Explained feature. It's an incredibly topical one this week with all the geopolitical drama afoot. How can I back defence stocks without buying individual shares? Rob?
Yeah, thanks, Lee. The defence industry is definitely increasingly the focus of attention in markets at the moment, particularly with those growing security concerns in Europe and potentially significant government spending in that area. So buying individual shares in certain defence companies is more risky. You take on that additional single business risk. You can instead buy a basket of defence shares to diversify and spread the risk more. And a convenient way to do that is through an ETF, an exchange-traded fund, that buys a range of stocks in defence and related industries to play the theme. Now, an ETF or exchange-traded fund can be bought just like a share on the stock market, but it's a fund that holds a portfolio of assets. Often, that's a range of shares to represent a broad index, or they can be focused on a particular sector, in this case, defence. And there's a few options in this specific area on investment platforms such as Charles Stanley Direct, and a number of ETFs have launched in recent years seeking to capitalise on growing interest in the sector. Now, they do vary from one another a bit. As with a lot of these thematic areas, there's not a standardised way of capturing the defence theme. Products tend to target the wider defence ecosystem, and there's often a trade-off between purity to that theme in terms of underlying revenues from defence activities and diversification. Many companies have civil or non-defence parts to their business, so often you're not getting exposure purely to defence. So that's something to bear in mind when looking at the different options. Look at the index being followed by the ETF and the holdings to ensure it's what you're looking for. Some are weighted more to general aerospace as well, and some actually towards more tech-related areas such as cybersecurity. Remember as well, even when you're diversifying with an ETF, it's still risky. All investments can go down as well as up, and very specific funds like this can experience greater ups and downs than the wider market. It should also be noted that defence shares have already moved up quite a bit in recent times with what's been going on. Though as a structural longer-term theme, it could still be attractive if global instability continues and defence spending ramps up, albeit the winners at a company level do remain quite uncertain. It's also a long cycle industry where orders take a long time to convert into company profits.
That is Rob Morgan from Charles Stanley Direct.
Welcome back. From water to council tax, bills. They're going up next month, by the way. We're not calling it Awful April. Lee doesn't like that. But we can call it Billmageddon, apparently, which I do think is a better title for it. So how can you lessen the pain of Billmageddon? Lee.
Six bills.
What's going up?
One household. Welcome to Billmageddon, starring you.
Yeah, there's there's
your wallet.
Awful April. I mean, the thing that gets me of Awful April is that I quite like April. You know, it's a nice month. The weather starts spring. To turn, you know, spring. Wife's birthday, second daughter's birthday, lots to celebrate, usually Easter. Yeah. It's a nice month. Awful April, it just isn't nice, is it? I don't like it.
But lots of bills, lots of things going up.
Lots of things.
Stamp duties changing as well, of course, but
lots of things about to buy. And just to give you a quick rundown, I mean, first of all, I should say this. Some of this stuff you can kind of maybe sidestep and probably kick the can down the road a little bit. Some of this stuff is just going to be very difficult. Some of these bills are going to be very difficult to get out of. you know, in terms of the rises. So let's start with energy bills. We know that the energy price cap is going up by £111 next month to £1,849 a year. That's for the typical household with typical usage. It will be higher if you're in a bigger house and use more energy, lower if you're, you know, in a one-person house, for example. That's up 6.4%. Most households, 22 million, it's sort of estimated, are still on a variable rate tariff. So what happened was lots of us were shunted into those tariffs after the energy crisis. Fixed rates disappeared. Fixed rates are back. Fixed tariffs are back. You can have a look. If you go on thisismoney.co.uk/energy, you can put in your postcode into our deal finder and see if you can save money by fixing. Now, you switch are saying typically you could probably save about £140 by fixing. There is a little bit of a danger that the price cap might come down, for example, in the summer. But the predictions at the moment that if there is a fall, it's going to be quite small. The other thing I should say about this, of course, as well, that when this bites in April, we're going to be a lot less energy intensive. You know, it's the winter really where most of our energy bills naturally come from, because we're turning on the central heating more, we're turning the lights on more, we're just more energy intensive in the winter. So there is that kind of little chink of light. What the real key thing will be is what the price cap will be by October, when the weather starts turning back around the other way again, and we get, you know, more. So if you think about it, if you fix now, you'll be kind of fixing for the winter of 2025, because you're now at the other end. It's almost like a kind of gamble, a bet on whether you think the price cap is going to go down. Because if it's going to go down, then you might have been able to save money. If it, of course, it can easily go the other way with all of the kind of geopolitical things that are going on at the moment. Mm-hmm. So if you prefer the security and the safety of being on a fix, you can do that instead. It fixes the unit prices of what you're paying. There's been a bit of a shift recently as well for suppliers to be offering tariffs with no standing charges, the hated standing charges stuff. If you're in a really, really small household in which you really do not feel like you use much salt, it might be worth checking out. It's one of those things where you need to sort of sit down with a calculator, crunch what you're using, probably look back over the last 12 months. There's so much data at our fingertips when it comes to our bills that you can kind of go back and have a look and see if it would be something that would work for you. There's loads of energy tips on that link as well. thisismoney.co.uk/energy. Stuff that actually works. I'm not going to sit here and say, turn the thermostat down and all that kind of stuff, because you know that. You've heard that.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
You know, and it is meant to get a bit colder next week. And you know, I think everyone that listens to this podcast knows those kind of old hat techniques. But fixing could be the right thing. So go and investigate it. A big one that is by
quite a lot of potential savings, though, there. I mean, just looking at your article, £560. That seems a lot.
Well, I think that that's, you know, going right
the upper end of optimism.
That's if that's if you're starting to do things like, you know, proper work around the house, you know.
Got it.
That's not for fixing your energy bill. That's doing like, you know, putting in insulation and things like that.
Yeah, for sure.
Potential savings, £560. If you're going to be going on to a fixed rate, it's going to be more like probably £100 over the course.
Still, you know, not to be sniffed at, Lee.
Definitely not to be sniffed at. I fixed a few months ago.
Me too.
And I think it was the right decision, if I'm being honest. It could fall a little bit and I might save a few quid. But what the real thing is for me with why I fixed is that I'm worried it will go way up the other way. I can't see it going way down. I can only really see it nudging down or going up the other way. So that's why I did it. The big one that's coming, I think, next month, that's passed a lot of people by, is water bills.
It's got a lot of headlines now. Some of the proposals for increases have been enormous. They haven't been given the green light, but it's still big.
I feel like if you ask the general public, it hasn't cut through as much. You know, the energy stuff, really, people are kind of on it. They kind of know about it more. I think water is one of those utilities that we take quite for granted. You know, it's one of those things where you just don't think about it as much. I think because the bills are that much lower, typically annually, and it comes out in kind of small amounts as a direct debit out of your account, typically for most people, that you don't really notice it as much. But from April, the typical water bill in England and Wales is expected to go up £10 a month. That doesn't sound like a huge amount, but industry body Water UK, so bills are up, going to be rising an average of 26%. That's a lot when you hear it in percentage terms, to £603 from £480. And some areas are facing way bigger increases than that. So, for example, about 4.7 million customers, Southern Water customers living in Kent, Sussex and Hampshire, will see bills typically rise by 47% on April 1st.
That's enormous. Yearly costs jumping from 478, like you said, to £703.
Now, you're right, it's been well documented. There's some, Thames Water, for example, is in a lot of debt. And it's kind of worrying where this is heading. You can have a look and see if you can get a social tariff. It might not, you know, we have quite savvy podcast listeners, I would suggest, that potentially probably wouldn't benefit from that. But it's always like spreading the word. You know, if there's someone that you think is struggling with their bill or get certain benefits, you can find out if they're eligible for a social tariff. You can think about installing a water meter. They can typically save you about £100 a year. But there's a big caveat in this. You're charged for the water you use rather than set cost based on the value of your property. It means you have an incentive to use less. But there's a rule of thumb. If there are more bedrooms in a home than people, a meter could save you money. Worth looking into, worth asking people that have had a water meter fitted, because I've heard mixed things. And again, there's some tips you can do here. I mean, for example, having a water butt is actually quite a good idea. It rains a lot in this country. We've had quite a wet winter. You can get a 50-gallon water butt, £40 from a DIY store. That just takes the rainwater.
Better for your hair as well. Your skin condition, as your barber tells you. Exactly.
But for watering the garden in the summer and that kind of thing, it helps. Again, I don't want to bore you with the kind of have a shower instead of taking a bath, because you know that uses less water. I don't think there's anyone in this country that doesn't know that taking a shower is going to use less water than a bath. So one thing, though, that's in this is about a washing machine. I think a lot of us are guilty for just using the same setting on the washing machine all the time and not actually understanding how it works. Same with the dishwasher, actually, and whether eco modes work and things.
Eco mode keeps it going for hours.
Well, the thing is, so in this article that was in our sister paper, it says here a washing machine requires up to 150 litres of water per wash, but if you wash using the eco mode setting, it can use just 50 litres. That's quite a big difference, actually. I hadn't really thought about that. It might be worth checking out your... that really is a boring weekend job, isn't it? Digging out the brochure, the documents for your washing. I've got them all. They're all tucked away.
I'm
going to go through and check out all the settings. Next big one, again, a real bugbear of our readers, and we've talked about this quite a bit recently, is council tax. There's some councils that are raising bills by as much as 15%. That's in Wales. There's a few in England that are doing sort of up to 10%, the same as Scotland. It just depends where you live. Again, very hard to sidestep that. If you live alone or have an in living carer or share a property with a student or someone with a severe mental illness, you may be entitled to a 25% council tax discount. Again, that might be handy information for someone that you know. If it's not handy information for you, I think it's pretty well known, especially the single person discount.
I got a letter from my council saying, because you have got an extra bedroom in your home from previous measures, we're now moving you to a different council tax banding. I mean, basically, the previous owners turned the bathroom into a room that's so small you can't actually use it for anything. And it would have been so much better having the bathroom there. And now we have to pay an extra £500 a year.
Wow.
Before they're even going to increase prices in April. It's just...
That's a random thing to have happened to you. Yeah,
right? And about 2 months after we moved into this property and we had no idea about this, I thought, that is so annoying.
So you can challenge your bans. And it's one of those sort of things where it can be a bit dangerous, because if it decides that you're in the correct band and your neighbour's not, your neighbour might be moving into a more expensive band. You might go, that's fine. But it's whether if you get your band changed into one, actually they go, no, it shouldn't be lower, it should be higher, and you can end up paying more. But I think those cases are very few and far between. And again, it's worth just doing the research and figuring out, making a good case if you think that's something that you could, you know, benefit from. Another big one that's happened that's kind of annoyed our readers a lot is car tax. Motorists who previously paid £220 a year for a typical new car that emits 120 grams of carbon dioxide per kilometre will now pay £440. Vehicles registered between March 2001 and the end of 2017 will pay more road tax, typically between £5 and £25 a year. And EVs are no longer exempt from paying car tax. So if it was registered between April 2017 and March 2025, a standard rate of £195 will apply. New EVs will only have to pay £10 for the first year before switching onto the standard rate. But if you buy an EV for more than 40 grand, and let's face it, a lot of EVs are over that threshold because the technology is still in its infancy, you'll get what is known as the luxury car tax of £425 to be paid annually from the second to the sixth year. It's going to be hard to avoid this. We're seeing petrol prices nudging up at the forecourt as well at the moment. And the other thing I should mention here, talking about transport, is of course we've had train fares already bite the increases by this week. As I noticed, I kind of braced myself for it on Monday to see how much my train fare was up, and it's now ticked up over the £40 per day mark, which made me wince a little bit. Again, no way of really sidestepping that if you need to travel into
absolutely
work.
Absolutely insane.
It's an insane amount of money. But what's happened as I've got older, Georgie, and I've got calmer about these things, is that I was laying in bed last night and I was thinking, I'm paying £40 a day for train, but it was my choice to move out of London and commute into London. You know, it's my choice. If I wanted a job locally, I could get a job locally, couldn't I? You know, if I...
You work in High Street, Ken. Unless you've been given a massive bumping pay rise that I've never heard about, how are you going to afford a property in near High Street, Ken?
Well,
you have
no,
to
exactly.
move out of London.
Yeah, well, yeah. But I mean, I could still be within the parameters, I guess. But yeah, listen, I'm at ease. I'm at peace with it. But it is a lot of money. Lastly, I'm going to quickly rattle through these ones. So phone, internet, TV, they've had a nightmare, telecoms firms. Something that I pointed out last summer when I was watching an advert for EE, when it was telling how much bill rises would be for mid-contract, basically from April, in pounds and pence, it told you. And then I went away and worked out how much that was in percentage terms. And in percentage terms, it was way more than what they used to charge, which was RPI plus 3.9%. Instead, what these telecoms firms have done, they've been asked by Ofcom, forced by Ofcom, to tell people in pounds and pence how much their bill rises will be going from April 2025, mid-contract rises going on, and working them all out, pretty much all of them are way more than they would have been if they were just RPI plus 3.9%. So by simplifying something, they've made it more costly, which I think is absolutely ludicrous. So if you're someone that is out of the phone contract, you know the drill, go and find yourself, if you paid off the handset, go and save a fortune, go and find yourself a pay monthly deal because you already own the handset. Don't be that person that's lazily giving the telecoms firms money when you don't need to be. Loads are still great. I think broadband prices have stayed pretty stagnant over the last decade, if I'm being frank. Service has got better, speeds have got better. There's lots of options out there. Go and have a shop around if yours has been nudging higher, ticking higher, and you're not happy with it. And TV, you know, the TV license is going up another £5 from April. You can sidestep that by not watching live TV on your television. You just cannot watch iPlayer and you can't watch live TV. If you want to ditch that and just use a streaming service, you are within your rights to do that. But prepare to get a bombardment of letters saying you're not paying the TV license, just for your information. But that is up to you. That's your own call. You talked about it earlier, stamp duty. You ain't dodging that now.
Unless you can negotiate prices. But
yeah, it's going to be almost impossible now. If you're someone that is in the process of buying a home, you will be crossing your fingers, toes.
God, that's so mean. Know,
saying your prayers, just absolutely hoping that you're going to be able to get your house buy-in before this changes in April, because basically you don't pay stamp duty on a value up to 250 grand at the moment. That's cut in half from 125 grand. It was a temporary reprieve. It's going to be cut in half to 125 from April. It basically, you're going to be paying a few grand more, maybe a good 5, 6, 7 grand more, depending on the value of the house that you're buying. And you're going to really, 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 really hope that that gets through before April. Expect to see stories of frantic worry, fear, upset, annoyance, I would say, in the next month. It's such a horrible thing to have to pay. Listen, the house buying process can take ages. You know, it can, you could have been, you know, on the way from doing this, like in the summer of 2024, you know, even September, October, and it still hasn't gone through. There's so many variables, especially if you're in a long chain. So much can go wrong. So much can happen. You'd be gutted if you just missed this deadline and end up having to pay a fair few extra £1,000. I think a lot of people that would be buying a home would be factoring in that they might potentially have to pay this. If it's that tight, your finances are that tight that you can't suck this up.
Then yeah, so I was thinking it's a bit
of a worry anyway. But you know, if you are in that process, I honestly do have all my fingers and toes crossed for you, and I hope it goes through.
There was a stat on your website that was the number of first time homes in England. I think it was from Rightmove. That fall within the scope of stamp duty currently are 8.4%. That after April is going to rise to 32%. But what I thought more about this, which we don't really talk about, when we talk about first time homes, we probably think of, like, I don't know, studio apartments, one bedroom apartments, et cetera, et cetera. But just looking at the first time buyer statistics, in London it's 35, outside of London it's 33. At which stage, I don't know when you started procreating, Lee, but a lot of people will start now having kids. They'll have, you know, they want more space. It's different, the demands now. So I think that 32% is going to be even higher. And that, to find, yes, look, you shouldn't stretch yourself that far, but to find 2, 3, 4, 11 grand down the back of the sofa that you weren't expecting a month ago, or because some of these processes, yes, look, if you left it to the last minute, you knew this was happening. We've known this was happening as soon as the Labour Party came in and said that they weren't going to extend the temporary move. But even so, some of these processes take way longer. We had our sellers drag their heels for ages because they were going through a nasty divorce. I think it was a bit of a brouhaha between the two of them.
There's so much variable. That's the thing. And I was having this conversation actually this week with my wife. I've got a theory that you're kind of hitting the generation in which people don't particularly want to buy flats. I think first time buyers are kind of sort of moving into that rather own a house, rather have a garden kind of territory. I think that there's quite a bit of that going on, but the chain's mad. I mean, the house that we're in now, the chain went on. The kind of about three or four buyers up, there was an issue about, I can remember it. It was they had a gun cabinet in the house, and the buyers that were buying the house had to have the gun wrap cabinet removed, and it can only be removed by specially. You know, when you're just losing the will, I kind of thought, we're never actually going to buy this house, and it wasn't a year, but it wasn't far off. We'd handed in notice on our rental place. We were in limbo for a couple of months, wife and I, living back with parents, which is a situation you never want to find yourself in. I'd rather pay the extra few grand in stamp duty than have to do that again. But yeah, anyway, so it's going to be hard to dodge that now. There's going to be a lot of hard-working solicitors, I would say, and legal people trying to push things through, probably pulling weekend, you know, shifts, and godspeed those people that make the wheels turn of a property buying process.
In sum, basically, you don't like the term, but awful April it's probably going to be for some people. You're going to have to fork out a lot more than you were expecting. When you add all those things up, those bills, that is going to be thousands, rightly. Let's talk about auctions. What do you think of when you think of an auction house? Dusty antiques, tweed jackets, paddles in hand. Perfect, you think, for Ali. Yes, he'll fit right in. No. Yet he has become a big auction fan. Why? Because you can do it from the comfort of his own home. I was going to say his own shoffice. Although I do think tweed would suit you with the patches on the sleeves. You know the ones I'm thinking of. But you are quite the fan. Just what is it this about, Lee? You've written about this.
Yeah, I kind of, we've grown up on the diet of those TV shows, haven't we, where we've seen sort of auction houses and people putting up their paddles and making bids. And to be honest, I think I might be a little bit lost in a place like that, especially with experts who know their ching vases from their elbow. I mean, I honestly don't think that I'd fit in too well. Basically, a few years ago, I remember my old pal Jesse, who I wrote the book with, he was talking about sale room, and I never really kind of took much notice of it. And then probably about a year and a half ago, I kind of remembered about sale room, and I went and had a look, and I realized that I had a couple of auction houses nearby that were on sale room. So sale room basically connects all auction houses across the country. You create an account, and then you can bid online on these auctions from the comfort of your home, auctions all across the country. Now, I've successfully bid on quite a few auctions, But I do have some rules and some tips if you're someone that's tempted to do this. You can, of course, you can go in person and go and do these auctions. And the reason why I like Savrum is that it's very kind of tech savvy, brings it all together. You can look at all of the lots, very easy to bid on, very easy to put your card details on. But you do pay a premium for that, which I'll talk about in a sec. The other thing I say is that I'm a casual eBay user. I don't use it loads. Actually, what I find with eBay is like a lot of it's just buy it now. None of it really has that excitement of an auction. You know, it's not really an auction, is it? I mean, you get the timer when it's been listed and you might have a few different faces people bidding on it, but it's not the same thing as an auction house actually with a gavel, you know, and the 10 and the 20 and the 30 and the 40 and the 50 and all of that. You know, you don't have any of that at eBay. You kind of just sort of like you want that item and you're probably just going to bid on it. Anyway, listen, my five tips. Number one, I think, and personally speaking, I only bid locally for ease. So there's about three or four auction houses that are on Savrum that are within a sort of 10-15 mile radius from my house. I bid on those. What I really like to do is try and bid on the items that they say they won't post, because you are then narrowing down the amount of people that are going to be bidding on that. So think about things that are kind of like, you know, vases, but you know, like porcelain things that would smash in the post, and things like currency, so like old coins, all that kind of stuff, quite often they won't put in the post. So you're narrowing down that, and you're also dodging any posted and package drama, because usually you have to sort it yourself, and if you don't sort it quite quickly, I'm talking within days, you'll start getting storage fees from the auction house. They charge you for keeping, they want it off their premises to start the next auction. Do your homework on items. Now, you can't go and see it in person if you're obviously bidding online. I mean, you could go and see it in person and go off and bid online, but I've never done that. I look at the photograph, and they typically tend to have a few different photographs. You can really have a zoom in and really have a look at it. And although you can't hold it or feel it, you can see it. And then you can go away and hoover as much detail and data as you can on possible on an item that you're thinking about bidding. So what I do is I look through a lot, say at a local auction house A, I'll go through a whole lot, sometimes typically like 1,000 items, and I'll pluck out a few things that I like the look of, and I'll stick them on. You put a little heart next to it, puts it on a wish list. Then I go back on that wish list and I go and investigate. So for example of this, I saw this box of the Simpsons stuff. There's like toys and all sorts of things in it. And there was about 15 items in this box. So I went away and I actually researched every single item. Now there was a Simpsons alarm clock that was in this lot that hadn't been separately listed out. It was very light on details. And I went off and I searched it, and it was worth quite a lot of money, way more than what the auction estimate was. So I'll have a bit of that, and I bid on it, and I bought it for half the price, the whole box, everything that was included in it, for half the price of what I think the alarm clock is worth. If it's not, I'm just left with some items that I like, because I like The Simpsons. It's cool stuff. I've tucked it away nicely. I think it's cool. I don't care. On the flip side of that, auction probably last year, I saw a load of My Little Pony items going up. They've come round. They're really popular, really, really like the kind of collectible ones. You've got to set a limit, right? You need to be setting yourself a limit. Don't get swept up. Mm. These My Little Pony items were going for far beyond the estimates. Huge amounts of money. You have to set your limit. So don't get swept up. Don't go over the top of that. Which brings me on to number four. You've got to factor in the fees, right? So the buyer's premium typically tends to be 25 to 30%, which is a big sum. You have to build that on to whatever you're bidding. Yeah. So if you're bidding £100 on something, you're actually bidding £130 on something because of the premium. So I bought a brand new boxed, it hadn't been touched, pristine condition Atari Jaguar box games console, the last games console that Atari brought out. It wasn't massively popular. I saw it and I bid. I didn't want to pay more than £300 for it. I've seen them being sold in specialist shops around for way more than that. Anyway, I knew that I didn't want to pay more than £300 on it. So I bid £200, but that in reality is £260. So I wasn't going to go much beyond that, because if I bid £300, it would be £390. So anyway, got it for a bid £200, so I got it for £260. Again, couldn't be posted out. When I picked it up, lovely. And then you've got to time the lots. to basically to save time. You know, that is the good thing about doing it online rather than in person. You don't have to sit through every single lot. If there's lot number 288, you roughly know where that's going to be along the line. They roughly do 120 to 150 lots an hour. So you don't have to sit through it all. Just set an alarm, make sure you're all verified with your card details, and then you're ready to pounce on the item that you're actually interested in. I think it's really cool. I really like it. I've bought one of my favorite things that I bought a bag of ancient coins, and one of them was Charles the First jeton that was in there. This bag of old coins cost me £12, and it couldn't be posted out. So when it picked up, this coin is 400 years old. You know, it's really cool. And I think for £12, what am I getting for £12 these days? Not a lot. And I came home with it and I put it in the palm of my daughter and I said, this coin is 400 years old. And she couldn't get over it. She was just like, really? Aww. And she's turning over. So, you know, there's some cool stuff at these auctions. And I think if you follow those kind of tips, you can find yourself some bargains and some cool items.
So the key things that stood out for me from that are you don't have to wear tweed and don't get carried away with My Little Pony.
Yeah, I think that's probably quite solid advice.
All right, excellent. Right, winner of the coveted This Is Money mug this week is Matthew, although I don't think there's enough sucking up at the start, but that's fine. And it starts kind of poetically. Three things collided in my life this week, says Matthew. What a brilliant start. I'm going to steal that. And the result is a question for you guys. Firstly, the cost of my commute went up to a fairly eye-watering £6,000 a year for a season ticket on the train to London. We've covered that one. Secondly, my old man stayed in a Premier Inn and received a free breakfast as he holds shares in Whitbread. Who knew? Thirdly, the British ISA was again mentioned on your pod as a failed attempt to invest in UK business. My question is, would a carrot, perks, rather than a stick, lower cash ISA limits, be a better idea to get people investing in UK business? I mean, I don't know. Who wouldn't invest for a free breakfast, Lee?
Well, I think what he's saying is you've missed the crucial bit out of this, Georgie, which was his suggestion.
I left that for you, Lee.
Oh, okay. Which was his suggestion that instead, if he could invest into his train company for a discount, which I really liked. I thought, you know, that's quite a good thing. It's a kind of there are companies where you do get perks. You get investor perks for basically having money in it. Now, imagine if you could get a discount on a train because you've got shares in it. Now, the complicated thing about that, of course, is that the government is trying to kind of take it all back again after it's gone into sort of ownership of companies that are making profits and companies that are quite often not based in Britain. My local train company is owned by an Italian firm. In this case, it's a French firm. So it's kind of a little bit difficult, but I think it's an interesting thought. So you said, for example, if I could invest X amount in the train company, who, let's be honest, are trying to please shareholders, not passengers, and get a 5, 10, 25% discount on my travel, depending on amount invested, I'd think I'd do that. A cursory search online shows a handful of companies that offer perks but don't seem to publicise it. So Whitbread is one of those where if you invested, you get perks. There's some other examples. Winemaker Chapel Down, for example, you own shares. And some of the other breweries like Fuller, Smith & Turner, Adnam, Shepherd Neame, they offer small discounts and things if you are a shareholder. Whitbread investors with 64 shares or more get free breakfast at Premier Inns and 10% off meals at restaurants such as Beefy's, the Brewer's Fair and Table Table. They exist. These little things exist. I think some of the fashion houses as well. Mulberry, for example, if you own a certain amount of shares, you can bag sort of 20% discounts, which on an expensive bag is quite a lot. And Next has seen an absolute bumper recent years in terms of share price. They offer 25% shareholders 25% off one purchase a year if they earn 100 shares or more. These things exist. You can go out there and have a look there. I also think with train fares, Simon and I have this conversation at least once a month where we talk about it'd be really good to be able to salary sacrifice your train travel. But hey, look, I kind of like the idea of being able to buy into my local train company and have a discount. I think it's a good idea. I genuinely think it's a good idea. One last thing I'm going to say. We've had a few people message about their mugs. They're en route. They're on their way. We've had a bit of a delay sending them out, as these things are. They've been sent out in a batch. If you are someone that's won a mug so far, don't worry. Hopefully you will be drinking a nice steaming hot cup of tea, coffee, hot chocolate, hot toddy, whatever you like out of them soon.
Yeah. The phone lines are inundated. We're going to launch a callback request service soon, but we will endeavour to get this stuff out to you. But Matthew, that was a great question. Well done. You deserve that mug whenever it might be in your hands with tea or coffee in it. Right, that is it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into or you'd like to contact us with the question of the week for that eventual mug, they do exist, I promise you. Lee?
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can access This Is Money. We've also ramped up our Facebook stuff this
That's
week.
Still going?
We managed to log in after about a year and a half. we managed to retrieve our details. So go over on there as well. Go and show us some love. This Is Money on Facebook. And you can also comment in the article in which this podcast lives. Oh, and on Spotify now as well, as I pointed out recently.
Absolutely. I don't really listen to myself on the thing, but if I was to, I would listen to it there.
And you'd give it 5 stars and you'd leave a message on the review on the
that
Spotify.
Georgie is amazing. I mean, Lee's pretty good, but Georgie, she's out of this world.
Where's my mug?
1 star.
Yeah. No, 4 stars. 1 star off for not getting the mug yet. We do apologise. Sorry. They are coming. I know you're excited for them and it's really nice. It's just, the logistics.
Might even throw a tea bag in as well while we're...
You know, when I said about auctions and things that can't be posted out, it's kind of like one of those scenarios where it's trying to figure out how to get it to you without it all being smashed up. And anyway, I'm going to stop talking now. Bye.
All right. But if you do like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? Not on our delivery service, but on our podcast. It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.